Hi there, I'm Dustin Dwyer from Michigan Radio. If you've been listening to our series, An Idea on the Land, then you've heard the voice of Willie Jennings. He's a professor at Yale Divinity School and author of the book, The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. Jennings' work deals with subjects that, for some of us, can be very sensitive. The history of whiteness, the distorted view of Christianity that drove European colonialism. We've tried to present those ideas the best we could in our series, but after speaking to Jennings, I've had the sense that at least some people would want to hear more. So we're making this extended interview available as well. This has been lightly edited, mostly to clean up the audio. The quality is still not perfect at times, but you should be able to at least hear what's being said. I also want to mention Willie Jennings is scheduled to be in Grand Rapids this winter to give a talk for the January series at Calvin College. You can find info on that online. Jennings himself is a Calvin alum, and he grew up in Grand Rapids, the city where I live. That's where our conversation started. Jennings told me he grew up on the city's southeast side.
Yeah, southeast side of town. My house is not far from the corner of Franklin and Eastern. Right by the mother church of the Christian Reformed denomination, First Christian Reformed Church. It's about a couple hundred yards from my house. So I grew up in that side of town and went to elementary school on that side of town, Alexander Elementary, that I just found out is closed. And then I went to Madison Elementary, and then South Middle School, which all of which are gone. And Crescent High School, which is also gone. So all the institutions I went to no longer exist in Grand Rapids. I was just there recently, and it still looks very depressed.
Some parts of it, yeah. It's changing quite a bit, though, that part of town in particular. Eastern Avenue is going through, you know, when you see it, it looks depressed, but there's people holding on to that land.
Which is important.
Well, it depends on who's holding on to it. One of the biggest stories I did last year, I just got back from a fellowship, but the big story I did just last year was about a lot of rent and property values are going up like crazy around here, and a lot of people are getting pushed out, especially on the southeast side. Southeast side, the west side. And so a lot's changing on there.
Yeah, it's tragic. Yeah, I know from family members that the rent prices are skyrocketing, and you know, unfortunately, as you probably know, in the state of Michigan, it's illegal to put any kind of governors on rent. There, you can't do rent control, and it's just crazy. It's I think it's the worst form of kind of financial oppression we've seen in that state.
It's certainly affecting people in Grand Rapids quite a bit.
Yeah, I was at Calvin about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago. I did a week-long course, and we did had them do racial geography tours as a part of it. So I wanted to show them how race and place work together. And so we drove around Grand Rapids, and I have a nephew, Lonnie Legrone, who works for a nonprofit in town that's trying to advocate for fair housing. But it was so depressing to see, you know, the financial and geographic setup, racial setup of Grand Rapids, where you have these very poor Black and Hispanic peoples there in Grand Rapids who rent and who are subject to increased rent prices, and they don't have the wherewithal to pay all that. But there's no one who can really advocate for them, given the laws in the state, which allow people who own and rent to do whatever they want to, basically.
And Grand Rapids is one of the most segregated and economically divergent or disparate cities in the country.
I mean, yes, it is.
The black, I keep trying to tell people this, but the poverty rate, if you're black in Grand Rapids, the poverty rate is higher here than in Detroit. The disparities are just like nowhere else in Michigan, really.
There was a Forbes report recently which rated Grand Rapids as one of the best places in the country to live if you're white. And one of the worst places to live if you're black. Oh, it's amazing how that can be the case. And as you know, there's a lot of money in Grand Rapids and in Michigan.
And, you know, a lot of that money is coming into the southeast side now. The DeVos family is buying a lot of property on the southeast side. They've got a new organization. I forget what they're calling it. They've got a name for it anyway. And then ICCF is buying up a bunch of property with the goal of trying to stabilize housing and get people toward home ownership. But we'll see, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I have great worries about that.
As a lot of people do, I believe, yeah. Well, I wonder if we can talk about your work. I had a good friend who sent me your lecture, which I realize is now almost a year ago, Can White People Be Saved? But yeah. It was new to me, and I really kind of blew her mind, and she shared it with me. I was thinking about doing this story I wanted to do about the history of, I was interested in just doing a story about trees, and then I got interested in telling a story about logging in Michigan, and then I realized that story is inseparable from the story of what happened to the people of Michigan, and around about that time when I was having those, thinking through that story is when my friend sent me your lecture, and the way that an ideology of a people can, an ideology and a theology and an identity can come to bear on the land. I wonder if I could just ask you, to explain, so I have it on the recording. Like, in your studies, in your explanation of it, where does whiteness begin? When did that idea come about, and how did it come about?
Well, whiteness came about because I like to say it was a perfect storm of three things that came together at the same time that created whiteness. And here we want to think about whiteness not simply as a way of being in the world, but as a way of seeing the world at the same time. And whiteness formed because of three things. One, because of the unprecedented event of what we would now call Europeans coming to the New World and realizing unprecedented power in the New World, power over peoples, and the possibility of ownership in ways that they had never before experienced. And they came already with a very deformed view of their faith. They came believing that they were the people of God, having replaced Israel as the people of God. And so that God's hopes for the world rested on them. They were God's chosen, and God, through God's marvelous providence, had brought them to the New World. And so there was a sense of responsibility, and to go along with that sense of unprecedented power. And then the third reality that helped to create whiteness was the realization that they are looking at people, they're seeing people who they had never imagined existed in the vast variety that they existed. And they started to make, you know, basic observations about the difference between the people they looked at and themselves. And by way of comparison, they drew on what they had already understood. The ideas of white and black weren't invented when they came to the New World. They were simply made use of in new and strange ways. So they drew comparisons between their bodies, their body types, their facial features, their hands, their legs, their arms, and the multiple indigenous peoples, trying to make sense of this vast variety and array of people. And what began as really harmless designation soon took on a world of harm as they did one crucial thing with their life in the New World. They seized land. So whiteness, and whiteness specifically, and race more generally, results in incredible power in the hands of people we would now call Europeans, join with the stark act of taking what was not theirs, taking land, believing that they had right to it because God had brought them there.
I'm interested in, I've heard at least some of the theories around whiteness and some of the whiteness studies that have been happening and some studies around colonialism that has been happening. You come at it from an angle of theology and as a Christian scholar. What do you learn or gain by bringing the Christian faith into it or their understanding of their Christian faith into your understanding of what they did and their ideas about the land that they brought?
Yeah. The missing element that's been present in most of the studies on race, on whiteness, and on colonialism has been the Christian element. Christians were recognized as being there at the very beginning, but we were not recognized as being the womb within which race and whiteness comes to life. It requires Christianity as a vision to help make whiteness a vision because of its comprehensiveness, its way of seeing the whole world through the lens of a white body. And so the difference, there's a couple of kind of crucial points here to hold on to when it comes to understanding whiteness and the Christian difference. The one has to do with a vision of the world that is comprehensive, that can capture everyone, that can see everyone within it, and while allowing for people's diversity, but to manage and control that diversity within one overarching vision. And that comes from Christianity. And let me explain what I mean by that. So within Christianity, you can look at the whole world through a very basic lens as sinner and saved. Anyone can be a sinner. In fact, everyone is a sinner and anyone can be saved. Anyone can become a Christian. It's a designation that is both specific and general at the same time. It is elastic enough, expansive enough to capture the whole world. Well, growing out of that, the idea of race, of racial identity, has those same characteristics, that same elasticity. Anybody can be fit within a framework that has white at one end, let's say at the supreme positive imperial end, and black at the other end as the most derogatory servitude end of that spectrum. The whole world can be placed within that. That's not to say that the whole world is boiled down to white and black, but the whole world can be gauged within it. That grows out of Christianity. What also grows out of Christianity is a vision of the world that belongs to God and to whomever God chooses to give that world. And that world, according to so many Christians, so many colonial Christians, throughout the vast colonial theater that they inhabited, they believe that God had given them that world as possession. And so they helped to create a new vision of the world as not only a possession given by God, but as infinitely possessible and a form of possession that can be broken down and tied to individuals, i.e. individual private ownership of the world itself. And this had a deeply Christian, deeply theological character from the very beginning.
I have a piece of writing that I wanted to check by you because when I read this, it was the moment when your ideas that I had heard in your lecture were not just ideas or a critique, but that I was surprised at how literal they were. So Lewis Cass, who was the second governor of Michigan, one of the powers that be that made the Northwest Territory and carved it into Michigan. He was also Andrew Jackson's head of Indian affairs, and we know who Andrew Jackson was. So Lewis Cass has a particular history. He wrote something about thoughts on Indians and their removal, in which he advocated for their removal. And I just want to read you this quote. He wrote, "There can be no doubt, and such are the views of the elementary writers upon the subject, that the Creator intended the earth should be reclaimed from a state of nature and cultivated, that the human race should spread over it, procuring from it the means of comfortable subsistence and of increase and improvement. A tribe of wandering hunters dependent upon the chase for support and deriving from it from the forests and rivers and lakes of an immense continent have a very imperfect possession over the country over which they roam."
Yeah.
it wasn't hidden. It wasn't in metaphor. No. They just came right out and said it.
Oh, absolutely. And what precedes Cass's sensibilities are hundreds of years and thousands of other early colonialists who carry those very sentiments and said them even more starkly, that the indigenous peoples did not understand what they looked at. They did not understand the world as God's creation, and therefore they did not understand what it meant to be responsible for it. And so they imagined that their job was to do two things at the same time. Bring the world to its maturity, that is, bring nature to its maturity through its productive use, through extraction, and at the same time, bring the indigenous peoples to maturity by transforming them, by assimilating them. And those who would not assimilate, they would kill. There was the famous statement made, I'm not sure who made it first, but it was often repeated, kill the Indian, save the child. And this was a motto deeply inside the educational efforts aimed at indigenous peoples to try to burn out of them any deep sensibilities that tied their lives, their bodies, their minds to the earth, to land, to trees, to rivers, to burn that out of them, to burn out of them any sense of deep connectivity and relationality with one another and with the land, and instill in them the man, the idea of the man, a masculinity that would aim at individual property ownership as the basis for building society.
And where did the idea of private property come into it from a Christian perspective?
The idea began inside the church's dictums, the church's decisions to grant to its Christian rulers possession and authority over all those lands where their princes and their magistrates and all their Christian leaders, to use our more contemporary language, would reign and bring all the inhabitants into the fold of Christ, that is, to Christianize them. And so the idea of possession began inside the gifting that the church imagined, the Roman Catholic Church imagined, that was its right to give. It was a right that also the Protestant churches imagined, that because God had given them power over the lands, brought them to the lands, that in of itself, that providential act, was also an act of possession. Now, the interesting thing about the development of private property in the New World is that it's driven by two factors. One is just as ancient as time itself, and that is greed. And it's a greed built on the awesomeness of a new world. You know, imagine coming to Michigan, or coming to Virginia, or coming to Peru. But let's stick with Michigan. Imagine coming to Michigan 300 years ago, 350 years ago, and standing where we would now, what we now would call Holland, and looking out at the vastness of Lake Michigan. So vast that you think it's a part of the ocean, and until you realize that, no, this is actually a lake. And then, you know, months later, years later, you find yourself in the, what we now call the Upper Peninsula, and you're staring out at the majesty of Lake Superior and the beauty of the trees and the fruit and the animals. And of course, there are people. And someone whispers to you, all this is yours. All this is yours. And so what only a few people experienced in the old world of Europe, that is, to be at the level where you could be, you know, not a landowner as we understand it, but someone who, by decree of the king, by the decree of royalty, is able to oversee some land. But here in the new world, you will exist as your own king. You have been given, you've been given land. In what we would now call Latin America, though probably the more appropriate thing would just be say in America, but in what we would now call Latin America, there were many a conquistador who the kings of the old world, of Spain and Portugal, would give these soldiers, because of their dedication and their bravery and service, grant them land. 80,000, 90,000 acres of land and everything on it. Imagine what that would do to you if your life in the old world was basically a life that encompassed 25 square miles. And now here in the new world, you've been given 80,000 acres. There was a time when the state of Virginia was owned by, I believe it was six people. So, you know, that's the one side, the greed side. The other, as I said, is the kind of hubris that comes with theological decree, with religious decree, that God has given you this. And no one has the power to keep you from taking it.
Well, and not just taking it, but having a particular use for it. I mean, in the history of Michigan and in the United States, they really prioritized agriculture, and you see writings from Thomas Jefferson on stuff like this, and you know the farmer is who he imagines the United States will be made of, and so Michigan was forest and swamp.
Yes,
and they cut down all the trees, they drained the swamps, and now when you drive across it, it's all cornfields.
Yeah.
To this day, why did they not just own the land and not just take things from the land, but envision the land as a particular, for one particular use?
Well, you have to remember that, and this is also tied to its Christian past, when Christian colonial settlers came to the New World, they were concerned about doing two things. One, they wanted to eradicate, especially among the indigenous peoples, any idea for them that smacked of demon possession and or heresy. And that is any idea that that suggested that people were deeply connected to the land and that the land was animate and communicative, the land and the animals, the birds and the streams, that these things were alive and speaking and interacting. For most Christian settlers, those ideas were deeply disturbing, demonically inspired, primitive, intellectually backward and deficient. And so they wanted to eradicate that idea because for them, the land was not alive in those ways. Those ways sounded anti-Christian. They sounded as though someone was being oppressed by demonic voices and forces. To imagine spirits, the spirits of the trees, the spirits of the earth speaking. So they want to eradicate that way of looking at the world. And at the same time, they initiated the new world in a practice that would come to this very moment. What practice is that? Extraction. Why? Because new global markets were developing in the Atlantic first, but then in other places, markets that would allow for the exchange of goods and services and at a rate and at a volume that the world had not seen. And so the way they looked at the land from the very beginning, from Michigan to Maine, from Virginia to Florida, they looked at the land as the world in potential that needed development. And that development was always tied to what can be taken from the land. How might we make the land actually come alive in the way it's supposed to come alive? Not through a kind of symbiosis and a careful listening to the land, but of making the land speak what we want it to speak. Corn and wheat and apples and barley and rice. We will make the land speak in the way we want to make the land speak. And we will turn animals from our relatives into simply things to be used or things to be eradicated because they're in the way of our use. Yes. Everything turned into commodity. This is part of what we don't understand in the history of the West, especially since the beginning of the colonial moment in the 15th century. To know a thing and to possess a thing have always been two sides of the same coin. And to experiment on a thing and to produce a thing have always been two sides of another coin. And so possession and knowledge, development and experimentation become the ways in which we imagine we are properly touching the earth, properly making use of it.
Where do these ideas come from? Is it this idea of maturity? Does it come from scripture? Why did these particular ideas about land develop?
Yeah. In part it does. In part it comes from the idea that within Christianity that our lives are aimed toward growth in Christ, in Jesus Christ. And we have been charged one to another with aiding each other in that growth. Well, that basic idea got legs. And it came to the new world, but when it came to the new world, it was a different kind of beast. And when it came to the new world, it was the idea that it is our responsibility to bring the world to maturity. It is a work of love. It is an act of mercy and of grace to bring a world that doesn't know its own deep goodness and richness to bring it to maturity. And to bring people to maturity.
When you say our responsibility, you mean our, the people who believe themselves to be white. That's where the sort of whiteness gave them that role.
Yes. Whiteness has always been a deformed vision of maturity, a deformed vision of what it means to be mature, to bring the world to its maturity.
I feel like I have to interrupt my learning of your ideas to just ask you about what's your experience of these ideas? You've been developing your ideas here in your writings for a long time on both whiteness and Christianity, subjects for which if you're in a room talking to people about it, people can be quite sensitive about, I imagine. How do people react these days?
Well, what I try to say to people, and people tend to react very well, whiteness should not be understood first as a person or a people, a gender, or even a nation. Whiteness should be understood as a way of being in the world that anyone can inhabit. And therefore, if we understand it as a way of being in the world, a way of imagining the world inside of possession and imperialist ways of thinking about how we bring people to maturity, then we can see that there is a difference between what whiteness is and who we are and what we can be. It becomes difficult for people, and it does become difficult for some people, when they've never heard any of this before, and all of this is so new. and they have made whiteness the equivalent of their skin. That it's the analogy I use, it's like wearing a set of clothes so long that it becomes so comfortable that you forgot that they were actually clothes and not your skin. But for some people, that's been their history. You see, the project of becoming white was a project placed in the laps of almost every immigrant group that came to these shores. There was a time in America when if you walked down the streets, what you would hear most often would not be English. You'd hear many other languages. There was also a time in America when many people would not have imagined themselves white, who obviously today would easily see themselves white. Many immigrant groups understood that in order to survive in America, they would have to mold themselves, form themselves, reshape their names, change their names, change the way they dress, change their look if they could, to represent a certain kind of Anglo-Saxon white type for the sake of survival and for the sake of thriving in this new world. Well, we've forgotten that long and bitter and painful history, because whiteness has been an achievement for some and it remains a quest for others. So what I try to do is to help people understand the history that they're inside of. And if they can see the history that they're inside of, then they can start to imagine some other choices. Of course, as one person said to me many years ago, why would anybody ever want to give up being white if it's an achievement? And, you know, the answer to that question is only if you see that there are better ways to be in the world. And I believe that there are.
Do you... Yeah, I, as a person who has embodied whiteness my whole life, I try to make the same argument with my cousins and whatnot. but have you ever think, well, maybe instead of maybe you're past this point now, but at some point ever think, well, maybe I should just not use the word whiteness. Maybe I could say settler or colonialist or capitalist or something like that, that might describe similar modes of thinking, at least in terms of the things we've been talking about, but maybe not all of them. What do you gain by using this term, which many people struggle with understanding, versus using other terms?
What you gain is that you gain an accurate touch of the point of distortion. The point of distortion is found precisely in the feelings that surround whiteness. There's feelings that surround it that have to be explored and opened up so that people can be freed from that. In my classes, there's a class I used to teach a lot, and what I would do in one particular class is I would write the word white on the board, and then I would take two fingers and I would start tapping the board, tap, tap, tap. And some students, every time I tapped the board, they would jump. And I would say to them, you know, what am I doing? And they would sit silently, and then I'd say, all I'm doing is touching a word on the board. This is not you. But the identification was so thorough that they imagined it was. And so part of the goal is to help people see as precisely as we can the problem of the distortion. Whiteness as a way of being in the world can't be opened up and presented as only one way of being in the world unless we talk about whiteness. So that's always been part of the difficulty. There's a great book these days I tell people that they ought to read. It's by Robin DiAngelo. It's called The Fragility of Whiteness.
I've interviewed her, and we did a story about it, and that's one of the reasons I know how touchy people can be about it, because we got a lot of feedback on that story.
I'm sure you did. You know, and it's the thing, unfortunately for so many people, they have never been given the history of immigrant transformation. They've never been told the history of, as one author said many years ago, how the Irish became white, or how Italians became white, or how Jews became white, or how Polish people became white, or how the Dutch became white. They've never been given that story of immigrant transformation. And because they've never been given that story, they don't understand what the horror that's behind walking around in this world imagining oneself as white. And until they can be given access to that story, to remember what people gave up in order to be acceptable and accepted, in order to survive in a country that demanded a deep, painful assimilation, the riches of the diversity that is around us in God's world will always remain for them a very shallow thing.
Yeah. I'm aware that we don't have all day. I certainly could ask questions all day, but I wanted to talk to you about sort of how do we begin to free ourselves from some of these ideas, as you say, to sort of find a different way of being in the world. Where do you suggest we start?
Well, and I can do this at two levels. For people who are Christian, we have a lot of work to do, those of us who are Christian. And that work begins with us getting a sense once more of the heart of the biblical story, which is not about Christians first, but about the people of Israel and about we who are not of Israel, that is Gentiles, being joined to another people, entering into their stories. There is a deep humility that should shape the way Christians live in this world that has been missing from the way we live in this world. And what I try to do is to invite Christians to learn again of not only our Gentile beginnings, but our very Gentile nature as those who've entered the story of another people, and to live inside the life of a learner, the humility of a learner, wanting to open ourselves to others. So for Christians, I want them to begin there. But for everyone, I think where we have to begin is where you and I began our conversation about. We have to start talking about where we live and how we live. Whiteness and racial identity more generally, it thrives because of segregation and segregated spaces. And what we all have to start to take very seriously is the immorality, the horror, the terror, if you will, of segregated spaces. And we have to do a much better job of thinking with real estate people, city planners, developers, community organizers about the morality of space and of places, of where people live and how they live. We shouldn't imagine those things are just immoral realities shaped only by market forces. The very character of who we are as human beings and as communities is dependent upon how we attend to place. And race, especially whiteness, whiteness will continue to thrive and exist and be a fundamental problem for life together as long as we don't think about place.
Can I ask, as part of that, though, and I've been thinking about this quite a bit. As I said, I live in Grand Rapids. I've reported, so you know some of the areas mm-hmm. around here. You grew up on Franklin. What about mm-hmm. wealthy? I don't know if you've had time to spend time there, but when I first moved to Grand Rapids in about 2009, and wealthy was a place where it was mostly black people walking up and down the street. There were black owned businesses, and there were a few new. There was a coffee shop. There was a new restaurant. You go there now, it's been totally gentrified. And right. I've had people who live a block from there on the southeast side, a woman specifically who told me she's lived there her whole life, and she doesn't go to wealthy anymore, one block from her house, because right. she says she doesn't feel comfortable there. because at a certain point it became a place for white people. And there may have been a point in time when those white people believed they were creating a sort of integrated space. And in fact, when I did the story about Wealthy Street, a lot of people were upset and offended that I would say that what was happening on Wealthy Street may not have been progress.
No, I understand what you're saying. And gentrification is a problem everywhere. Where I used to live in Durham, North Carolina, it's becoming gentrified. The problem with gentrification is not that you have white people coming. The problem with gentrification is that you have people coming who are oblivious to the very places that they're coming to, and who enter a place not intending to actually enter the place, but to colonize a space, to not ask about its history, to not care about its inhabitants, and to not fight to sustain ways of life that they themselves ought to enter rather than simply come and recreate. Everywhere there's gentrification, you have the obliviousness of place bound up inside people who may be well-meaning in their hearts, but they, even though they've moved to a place, they're really not thinking about the place other than as a place that they can own. So I don't think the answer is to keep communities segregated. I think the answer is to get people to start to take seriously the ethics and morality of place. I would love to see many communities that are segregated become integrated, but integrated in a way that the housing, the rents don't go up. Integrated in a way that city officials are required to spend money on the school system and on the bus system. And developers are required not simply to build houses, but to build sidewalks. And cities have to have bus lines that run everywhere and not only a few places. That is, I would love for people to start to think about place as though it is the sites of real meeting and not simply the places we own. And, you know, in Grand Rapids and across this country, gentrification is happening everywhere. And the deepest tragedy is that it's missed opportunities to get people to take seriously their basic responsibilities to be human. That when you live in a place, you have to see yourself not only as someone who owns the place, but as a guest in a place that you're only borrowing for the fleeting time of your life or the fleeting time that you're going to be there. And that the place that you inhabit ought to sense your presence as a helpful, healing presence and not simply somebody who's coming to take and take, extract, use, and then move on. Too many people live in this world like locusts, even though they imagine in their hearts that they're butterflies.
And the implications of what you're saying to me, it's not just as simple as moving people around. I mean, some of these questions get down to the very idea of owning property. I mean, how can I own a piece of property, one that was stolen or at least sold through a treaty that was questionably obtained?
Right.
So.
And that's wonderful. I think it would be great. I mean, this is part of what when I go places, I say one of the things that every community needs, every city needs, something similar to what happened in South Africa at the end of apartheid, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that would study and talk about and expose the history of a city, area by area. Who was here before we were here? Who took this land? Who was it taken from? How did it happen? And to begin to build a sense of our responsibility, our civic responsibilities, based on the history of places. Now, you know, for some people, they imagine that because the land originally was stolen from indigenous peoples, well, there's nothing we can do. No, there's much we can do, because in many places in this country, those same indigenous peoples are still there. And we ought to take very seriously what it means to think about that this land was taken from them. And we must have serious conversations about returning the land. Now, for some people, that's just outrageous. Oh, there's no way. But here's the problem. The problem of not taking seriously the history of a place means that no matter how moral or ethical or upright or Christian you might imagine yourself being, if you don't want to take seriously the history of a place, then at the deepest levels of life, you're living a lie. And so many people don't ever want to imagine that they're living a lie. But if they don't even know the history of the place that they inhabit, how can they not? So I would begin there, and then to go from there to ask, I mean, there's so much that you learn about what needs to be done right once you know the history. So that already would give you a blueprint for how you might want to live. But to go from there to ask other questions about the quality and character of life in this place that I live, in this neighborhood, in this community, in this part of the city. You know, one of the great tragedies in the West, given our geographic imagination, is our geographic imagination is shaped inside what I call a very deep bifurcation and isolation. What do I mean by that? It means that you and I can live in a place, and right next door, right down the street, right around the corner, there could be someone in deep pain and suffering, and we see no responsibility, none, for that person, for that situation, because our moral obligations in our minds, it ends at our property line. Whatever happens over there, that's none of my business. Now, what we have to understand is that that is an absolutely bizarre, strange way to be a creature in this world. I'm not saying that people don't deserve their own privacy and no one wants somebody to be intrusive, but that's a different matter than having a sense of connection with those around you. And based on that sense of connection, to then live in a reality of relationality because you know there is a connection. But all these things have been in a sense, taken from us, we've never had a kind of deep geographic sensibility cultivated in us.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to ask you about dirt.
Good. I love to talk about dirt.
All right, let's talk about dirt. Why is dirt so important?
Dirt is everything. My mother was a gardener. She had picked cotton in the South. And every spring when she began her garden there in Grand Rapids, you know, Michigan has that rich black dirt, which is, in my opinion, I don't know if you have any North Carolinians listening to your program, but I always appreciate the superiority of Michigan dirt to that red clay dirt in the Carolinas, though there are some people who love that. Great, rich black dirt. And each spring, as the winter started to give way, right before it started to get actually really warm, but warm enough so that the ground was softer, my mom would go out and take all the weeds out of her garden. Have us do that, take all the weeds out. And then as a proper gardener would do, she would wet her dirt, you know, of top to bottom. And then she'd work the soil to make sure it's all nice and soft. And my mother, like so many others people who had been in the South, when she came north, you know, she learned how to store her seed and dry it over the winter. So she had her seed in various buckets and cans. And when she got her garden ready, she would, as I said, she'd wet the dirt and she'd tell me, "Willie, come on out here in the dirt with me." And I'd go out into the dirt with her and she'd say, stick your hands down the dirt. And she'd make me stick my hands into the dirt down to my elbows. That's how soft she had gotten it, down to my elbows. And she'd have her elbows almost up to her shoulder, up to the, almost to the end of her shoulders in that dirt. And she would turn to me and say, "You feel that? you feel that sun? That's life. That's life. Being young, I had no idea what she was talking about. And I used to get so tired of being stuck in that dirt. So, yes, Mama, I feel the life. And then she would laugh and say, go get my seat and bring it over here. And then she'd start to she'd start to plant her seeds. But the dirt was everything, right? I mean, the true key to growing anything is not the seed or the plant, where you bought it or where you got it. It's the dirt. And so the dirt was everything.